I'd like to welcome you to our next Global Health Perspectives podcast. This is in the next in a series where we try and look at issues at the nexus of smoking and bigger global health issues. My guest today is Ethan Nadelman, and I'm really thrilled to have him join us. Ethan, for many decades, has played a central role in thinking about drug policy that takes the discriminatory nature of it out of the system. He was the founder of the Drug Policy Alliance, has a background from Princeton and many years of academia, and has been a voice for change over many decades. So, Ethan, let me just start by asking you maybe just to sketch your own journey through academia to what got you going in the harm reduction area, particularly related to drug policy.
Sure, Derek. I mean, it really goes back to the 1980s, being in graduate school, working on a law degree and a PhD, and getting fascinated by the whole issue of drugs, international crime and law enforcement more generally, but about how our country, United States, and globally, we were dealing with the problem of illicit drugs. And it so happened that when I got involved in the issue, started studying it in the early 80s, around 83, it was really a kind of backwater issue. But as I was finishing my dissertation in 87, the drug war was exploding all around the world. It was becoming the number one issue in American public opinion. It was becoming on the front pages of newspapers and the major TV news stations all around the world. And so I had the kind of bizarre good fortune of having an issue I decided to start working on that seemed just sort of off the beaten track, all of a sudden become one of the top issues in American politics and global discussions. And really just one thing led to another. It was doing that first in academia and then having the opportunity to start an activist think tank in 1994. Which I call the Lindesmith Center, named after Alfred Lindesmith, who was the first prominent American academic to challenge conventional thinking about drugs and drug policy, and then creating the Drug Policy Alliance in 2000. But it was really, go deeper on that question. There really was a sense that I think I realized maybe in retrospect that I needed my intellectual interest to be connected to something I cared about personally with some passion. And the fact that I'd been using marijuana since I was 18, the fact that I could identify as an illicit drug user, even though I was obviously much less vulnerable to the harms of the drug war because I was white and middle class and in university, I mean, that gave me a sort of personal connection. And then what struck me that was that the more I read about the issue and the more I studied about the history and the politics and the science and the health, the more I realized that if you were following health and science, drug policy should be heading in one direction, whereas public opinion and the laws and politicians were heading in the other. And it was that growing gap between what drug policy should be and what it was becoming that just seemed to me like an intellectual and moral challenge or quandary that seemed worth devoting much of my life to.
Yeah, and in that process, I'm sure you faced the fact that there were obviously all these exclusionary policies, and what was lacking was any sense of empathy for the users, which seems to be at the basis of harm reduction, particularly in drug policy. What were some of the obstacles that you faced when people started even raising the possibilities of many of what become now accepted as harm reduction places in common society?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, first of all, it was the hypocrisy, which was just so glaring. Because if you look at alcohol and tobacco, between the two of them, they combine all the worst features of addiction and dependence and links with crime and violence and social degradation and blah, 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 that you have with all the other illicit drugs put together. Right. I mean, so and the fact that somehow these were the devils we knew, that alcohol and tobacco, we were familiar with them. And therefore, OK, let's learn how to live with them. And we're not, you know, we learned the experience of alcohol prohibition and we're not going to go that way. But here are these other drugs, you know, not just cocaine and heroin, but marijuana and psychedelics, that these were going to be demonized. And that anybody who not just sold them or made them, people even just simply consumed them, were going to be treated like criminals. That people who smoked a joint or took some cocaine or heroin were going to be treated as the moral and legal equivalents as people engaged in armed robbery or rape or theft. That just seemed ludicrous. And so, you know, when you mentioned the point about discriminatory, you know, for me, what became apparent was that there was a core principle involved here. And the core principle was that nobody but nobody deserves to be punished or discriminated against or amongst based solely upon the things we put into our body. Right? That there is no basis for discriminating between somebody who is a responsible alcohol user or a nicotine user and somebody who uses cocaine or heroin or psychedelics or whatever. And there's no basis for saying to imagine a mother who, God forbid, has two kids addicted, one to heroin and one to booze. What is the moral basis or scientific basis or health basis for saying to that parent, well, kid A, who's addicted to booze, we're going to treat one way, and kid B, who's addicted to heroin, which most physicians would tell you is in many respects less dangerous to be addicted to than the alcohol, we're going to treat with that person as fundamentally a criminal. So it was that fundamental principle of non-discrimination and of not punishing people based on what they put in their body that's always been the underlying driving sort of ethical, moral force behind my work, even if most people don't get it, because we're so bought into the broader cultural thing that's virtually global that these drugs are somehow okay and the other ones are not.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. You know, and I think of my experience in tobacco control, and over the last decades, I've made the point that we seem to have cleansed all people involved in tobacco control of smokers. They're being stigmatized, isolated, and ignored, and demonized in many ways in which folk using other illicit drugs were over years. And I wonder whether that was partly what drew you into giving a talk a couple of years ago at the a Mike Russell talk at a tobacco control meeting, where many people, I think, were fascinated that somebody with your depth of background in drug policy and harm reduction saw the linkage between the underlying concepts that could be applied to ending deaths and disease within the tobacco control area. Just love your thoughts about how you actually got to give that talk.
Well, I'll tell you, Derek, it was really came down to two things. Because remember, when we talk about this issue in the illicit drug area, we sometimes use the phrase harm reduction, and we sometimes use the phrase drug policy reform. And those two basic notions overlap substantially, but are not identical. And so what drew me to the fight around tobacco and tobacco harm reduction were really two things. The first one, and it's interesting, you know, I actually did a YouTube video, must have been 12, 13 years ago. And the basic, you know, argument I made was why we should not prohibit cigarettes, right? And it was based on the essential idea. I started off by saying I hate cigarettes. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. My dad died at the age of 58, and his addiction to cigarettes no doubt played some role in his premature death by a heart attack. So I've always hated cigarettes and would do almost anything to discourage people from smoking them and would be horrified at the thought that my daughter might take it up. Yet at the same time, I also realized that prohibiting cigarettes, although it might have the beneficial impact of reducing the number of people who smoke and who die of cancer and heart disease, that the negative consequences of a prohibitionist policy in terms of driving the remaining smokers into a black market, treating them as criminals, generating vast black markets, incarcerating millions of people, and there's reproducing all the harms of the illicit drug war with a tobacco prohibitionist policy, would be fundamentally bad public policy and immoral. So that was the first piece that drew me into it. And I remember even public opinion polls back then, we did one of them, in fact, showing that 45% of Americans would support a federal law in the next 10 years criminalizing all cigarettes. And that the two groups that most supported that idea were right-wing Christians and young people. I mean, it's very rare that you get young people and right-wing Christians sort of on the same, you know, ends of a public opinion poll thing. And then the second part of this was the growing realization that what is the role of harm reduction with respect to tobacco? I mean, obviously, nicotine patches and chewing gums, those all make sense. Encouraging people to smoke less tobacco, that made sense. But I became aware almost 20 years ago, you know, of the stuff that Brad Rodu, the academic, was beginning to put out around oral tobacco. I remember inviting him to one of our earliest conferences back in 2001, I think it was, around, you know, substitution for more dangerous drugs, methadone, methadone for illicit heroin, and then certain types of oral tobacco replacing cigarettes. So I became struck by the whole discussion around tobacco harm reduction. And then as vaping became more and more of an issue in the last 6, 7, 8 years, I became more and more interested in it. And even as I was still running Drug Policy Alliance, was paying attention to this issue around the debate over vaping and following the science and the evidence and tiptoeing into this issue and beginning to think about what are all the relationships between our illicit drug harm reduction work and the others. And that would lead to Jerry Stimson, who founded the Global Forum on Nicotine, and who had previously headed up Harm Reduction International, leading him to invite me to give the Michael Russell oration a few years ago.
So that's fascinating. And, just to remind people that Mike Russell, studied at my University of Cape Town all those years ago, went to London, and his most famous statement was that people smoke for the nicotine but die from the tar, and went on to be the inventor of nicotine gum, which was in common use. And many things flowed from that. I also think just to mention, when you spoke about oral tobacco, that this has been an important last few months, where the FDA has finally issued a statement saying that generalized types of snus actually have a lower risk than cigarettes across many outcomes. And that is the very first time the FDA have formally ruled on a product carrying a harm reduction statement backed by the federal agency. Hopefully we'll see some more of these, since the science around many of the e-cigarettes, vaping, and related products is probably as strong, and maybe even stronger, than the evidence of snus. But you've seen the debate around harm reduction in tobacco, and one of the questions we ask all the time is, why is it that so many people in tobacco control find it tough to accept the importance of harm reduction, when those same people in public health accept its role nowadays in drug policy and HIV/AIDS and many areas of public health?
Well, I'll tell you, I think it's a few things, Derek. I mean, first of all, the people in the area of illicit drug harm reduction, by and large, a large number of them get it fairly quickly. And it's notable that if you take some of the leaders in global harm reduction, I mean, not just myself, but if you look at Pat O'Hare, the founder of the International Harm Reduction Association, which is now known as Harm Reduction International, if you look at his successor, Jerry Stimson, who then left and founded Global Forum on Nicotine, if you look at Alex Wodak, the physician in Sydney, Australia, who's kind of the Australian equivalent of me, a kind of leading longtime drug policy reform person, I think Mark Tyndall in Canada, you see that people are essentially, they get the basic idea and they're sympathetic. It's just not been that much of a priority, in part because the tobacco harm reduction area doesn't yet deal with the issue of mass criminalization, law enforcement, the spread of HIV/AIDS, and also because the harm reduction movement, especially in the U.S. but elsewhere, is increasingly moved by the disparities around race. And that is not so much of an issue as yet in the tobacco harm reduction area. I'm sure it will become one as the crackdowns become more severe and it's beginning to show up. But that's one reason. I think the second reason is that the trauma of fighting with big tobacco. I mean, big tobacco has to have been just about the most venal, economic force manifestation of not just capitalism, but of state-controlled tobacco stuff, I mean, over the last century. And that the sordid tactics they engaged in, the dishonesty, the lying, the marketing to young people, I mean, I think that the anti-tobacco folks who fought with them, many of them were so traumatized by that battle that the whole notion of collaborating with them, it's like people, in the United States post the Cold War, who just couldn't get around the notion that we might collaborate with the Soviet Union or China, and who even begin to mimic the techniques of their old opponents as part of that battle. So I think that's really the second thing. The third thing, which is obviously played on the illicit drug harm reduction area, and it's one reason you see a difference, for example, in the way that the FDA and some other organizations are responding to, say, oral tobacco, the snus or the IQOS on the one hand and e-cigarettes on the other, is the issue of youth. Right. And that's, you know, I mean, obviously it's not just that, because you have people in the tobacco control, anti-harm reduction area who've been anti-snus. I mean, look at the European Union. You look at people who've been anti-IQOS, anti-anything that involves allowing people to get some pleasure from nicotine. Right. But I think you have that element there, that because of the youth component, that's given them, the sort of anti-harm reduction folks, an argument where basically they are sort of tossing out the science and saying if it presents a risk to young people, or a risk that young people might get involved with a new nicotine product, even if it's much less dangerous than cigarettes, well, we'll let any number of smokers die in order to prevent young people from getting involved with e-cigarettes. And I think that's the kind of, I mean, there's something really despicable about that kind of moral equation being put forward by some of the leading anti-harm reductionists from a simple moral perspective that should focus on the value of human life, but it is what it is.
Yeah, I think that's very profound and very succinctly put. It says a lot of the struggles that I think are going to be underway. Let me just turn before ending to our current COVID-19 pandemic. And first of all, really just keen to get your thoughts about, again, the theme of harm reduction being at the basis of everything which we are supposed to be trying to do. Everything from isolation to hand washing to the other social measures, we know are not going to be perfect, but we're hoping that they're going to take down the net risk for a population. So your thoughts about how this period could actually be a time for people to understand more deeply the importance of harm reduction. And before you discuss that, just want to know how you're doing and how's your family doing?
Yeah, no, I'm doing remarkably well through all this. Living in New York City, it's strange being in the living in the hot spot of the global pandemic. But in fact, it's quite civilized in the immediate area where I'm living. So I and my family are doing fine. I hope the same's true with you, Derek. You up in Connecticut?
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. But what I would say about that is, yes, I mean, obviously what we are doing with COVID right now, and especially in the U.S., I mean, China's a little bit different, but it is about a harm reduction strategy, recognizing that we probably cannot eliminate this virus until we have the vaccine, or even then might not be a full elimination. But I think there's another point going on here, and it's one of the fundamental mistakes that some people in the public health field make. You'll sometimes see the rhetoric in public health link the notion of illicit drugs or now cigarettes or even e-cigarettes with the notion of an epidemic and something that needs to be suppressed, and that we need, you know, totalitarian. I mean, if you think about it, a public health approach absent any human rights is potentially a totalitarian policy, right? To some extent, it needs to be if you have a plague that might wipe out the population, right? So public health, I mean, and one way to think about harm reduction is where public health and human rights intersects. It's about finding the right balance between the two of them. But I think I'm looking at some people, I mean, for example, you know, an interesting guy like Tom Frieden, right, who was the New York City Health Commissioner under Bloomberg 15, 20 years ago, who did some very good things on the issue of HIV/AIDS and needle exchange and overdose prevention, then went to run the CDC, now working back with Bloomberg again. He's been very, very prominently involved and I think quite intelligent in his comments and engagement about how the United States and other countries can best deal with COVID-19, how they can best deal with this. Yet at the same time, he's somebody who, when it came to issues like marijuana, and it's the same thing is true with e-cigarettes, is a prohibitionist at heart. He's an abstinence-only guy. And I think what happens is that there are some people in the public health field who fail to distinguish between a virus, a pandemic, a plague, where there's no demand whatsoever among people. There's no demand for COVID-19. There's no demand for you know, bubonic plague or for things like that. Conversely, when it comes to e-cigarettes or nicotine or cannabis or opioids, there is, in fact, a demand. There's a demand among people who find it a beneficial thing in their lives, even if ultimately their calculations are mistaken. There's a demand among people who are dependent or addicted to it, but who, you know, can't stop and should not be treated as criminals. And understanding that fundamental distinction between public health policies dealing with a threat that is not demand-driven, as opposed to a threat that is demand-driven, is, I think, fundamental to understanding harm reduction. And I think it's the failure of key public health authorities to make that distinction that results in them advocating for policies that deprive people of their human rights, that diminish them as human beings, and that ultimately can generate vast black markets with all of the sorts of attendant harms we've seen with the global war on drugs.
Well, Ethan, thank you. I mean, that is just spectacular. And I think when I think to my own country, South Africa, it is doing a rerun of the prohibitionist period of the 1920s. People under lockdown may not buy cigarettes and alcohol. It's a giant experiment on an entire societal level. And it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out, where I guess most people expect it'll play out the way we can predict it'll play out.
Well, I mean, Derek, what you can well imagine in South Africa, or if India is doing the same thing, you'll see a reduction in the number of people smoking, at least temporary. So you may see some reduction in the health, disease, or other harms associated with smoking. At the same time, you're going to see black markets emerging. You're going to see people actually taking greater risk vis-a-vis the pandemic in order to obtain the cigarettes to which they want or are addicted to. You're going to have people putting themselves at greater risk. You're going to have people spending more money for black market cigarettes instead of spending it on food and other basic things like that. You're going to have people being thrown in prison for selling cigarettes in violation of the thing, which is one of the worst and most dangerous things you can do in a pandemic. So the net trade-off in terms of whatever, and then you may also have people who are going through the anxiety, and you might see increases in domestic violence among people withdrawing from nicotine because they can't access this stuff. So I think it's a really foolish and backward and opportunistic way for the tobacco prohibitionists to try to advance their cause in a way that's remarkably irresponsible, not just from a public health perspective, but from a broader kind of social justice perspective.
Well, thank you enormously for that. And let me thank you as well for taking part now, particularly at this time. To all of those of you listening, we hope that you'll be able to go to the website and send us questions and queries to podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And remember, please do stay safe and stay positive. There will be a positive future coming out of this for all of us. Thank you.